loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about the Facebook purge of alternative news outlets. Pages that had millions of likes and followers were deleted as the company tries to tighten its control over user speech on its platform. And then we take a look at the political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, if the mainstream media is to be believed, Russian intelligence services, hackers, and internet trolls manipulated social media in 2016, while employees of the Trump campaign colluded with Russian spies to give the country Donald Trump as president. But in an exhaustive new article in Consortium News, Gareth Porter says that narrative simply isn't true. He says that a report done by the New York Times, which is cited as the definitive piece on this issue, is fundamentally flawed and journalistically irresponsible. Next, Andrew Brunson, an American pastor who has been held by Turkish authorities for 2 years on terrorism charges, which he has steadfastly denied, was convicted in a Turkish court today, but then immediately sentenced to time served and released. He left Turkey. Meanwhile, Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi told the Washington Post that they have video and audio evidence of Khashoggi being detained, tortured, murdered, and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate. Then, Syrian rebels appear to be complying with an agreement with Turkey and Russia to withdraw heavy weapons from Idlib and the buffer zone along the Turkish border. The Free Syrian Army already has confirmed that it has withdrawn all tanks and heavy guns from Idlib, the last rebel-held bastion in Syria. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, at least six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces today as the regular Friday demonstrations continue along the border with Gaza. A spokesperson for Gaza's health ministry said that over 250 Palestinians were wounded, including 154 who were shot with live ammunition. Banking Committee Chairman Senator Mike Crapo announced today the passage of the Hezbollah International Financing Prevention Amendments Act. The new law aims to turn up the pressure on the Lebanese group that is playing a significant role in the war in Syria. The law was passed with bipartisan support and now heads to President Trump to be signed into law. The United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child denounced the actions of the Saudi-led military alliance waging war on Yemen. The committee found that Saudi-led airstrikes have killed approximately 1,300 children. The strikes began in early 2015, meaning that the Saudis have killed roughly one child every day. The U.S. Postal Service has proposed a price hike of up to 12% for its Parcel Select shipping option. This service is primarily used by e-commerce firms, most notably Amazon. A U.S. Postal Service spokesman denied that the proposal was politically motivated. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the purge conducted by Facebook of hundreds of very popular Facebook pages. Facebook yesterday censored and deleted hundreds of pages from the website that the company deemed to be part of an entirely American effort to influence the public and to possibly swing votes in the upcoming midterm elections. The problem is that the company also deleted dozens, perhaps hundreds, of legitimate pages, including many where progressives get their news. The decision calls into question the role that private companies play in a democratic system. We're joined by Matt Savoy of the Free Thought Project, one of the pages that was deleted by Facebook. And later in this segment, we'll be joined from Washington, D.C. by Ford Fisher, the founder of the media startup News to Share. Matt Savoy, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Matt, your Free Thought Project was one of the pages deleted by Facebook, and you've also been deleted by Twitter. What kind of warning did you have? And did Facebook or Twitter give you any explanation for their actions?
Facebook said we violated their terms, which is like the standard operating procedure for when they ban you. You know that their terms are listed on their website, and it's very long, and you could, anybody could try to fit under any of the numerous different violations that they claim against you, you know. So we don't know exactly what terms we violated, but we assume that it's because we had multiple pages and And they're trying to purge independent media right before the election cycle, so we don't put out the information there that they don't want.
A lot of people, Matt Savoy, use your site or have used your page. 3.1 million likes or followers, is that right?
Yes, that is. And that was just one of our pages. We had several other ones. You know, we had roughly 6 million followers. And we also owned the largest police accountability page on Facebook, too, which was called Police to Police, with nearly 2 million followers.
Oh, yeah, of course. A lot of people use that site. So just talk about what the Free Thought Project, what your postings were about, what you did, what your philosophy is, and also the same with Police the Police. Just talk about it in case our audience may not know who you are, and also, you know, why you've been purged, why you've been censored by this mega monopoly, now working hand in glove with private think tanks like the Atlantic Council, which in turn are funded by NATO and other governmental agencies, and which in turn are working with the U.S. government. Go ahead.
Yes. So about 6 years ago, the co-founder of the Free Thought Project, Jason Bassler, and I, we saw a void in the market for independent media. We both worked for various different organizations, which I'm not going to name, but they kind of swung towards like the conspiracy theory and unprovable outlandish claims. And we got tired of like working under these people. So we decided to open up the Free Thought Project, and we weren't going to come with anything that we couldn't back up or anything that we didn't research ourselves and have, you know, accurate sources to do it. And there was a void in the market, and it blew up, you know. Subsequently, like overnight, we literally went from, you know, 15 people on the website to almost 8,000 congruent users at a time. And it was amazing. Facebook helped facilitate this. We grew our page, you know, to 3.1 million followers, and then we grew Police to Police to almost 2 million, and various other pages, dozens of other pages that we did like to specific causes, like in the drug war and things like this, so we could, you know, we could attack things from every different angle and try to insert that narrative out there. And within the last 2 years, after this fake news narrative came out, in 2016, after the election cycle, meaning the establishment media, saw the power, I believe, that independent media had, which is, I mean, when there's millions of people all researching topics and putting it out there and coming together in a community, that's far more powerful than, you know, one talking head on a cable TV channel just spouting the day's rhetoric that was handed to them from, you know, some government source. So I believe that we became a threat to the establishment, and so they put their sights on us, and that happened about 2 years ago, and we were attacked by Snopes and PolitiFact, and we had to send cease and desist letters, and they retracted those. You know, when Facebook started this fake news things, I'll elaborate on that. They set off these fact checkers, and if you shared a link that was deemed false news by one of these corporations like Snopes or PolitiFact, even the AFP, you would get a push notification saying that you shared fake news and this was deemed fake by these different organizations, right? So there was several of those that we got hit with, and that were egregious, right? They weren't actually fake news. So we had to go back and send cease and desist letters, and we spoke with people at PolitiFact and the Associated Press, and they actually retracted theirs. They reversed the rankings or the fake news rankings on Facebook, and everything was fine. Snopes, unfortunately, did not do that. They're a little bit different than PolitiFact and the AP. But so that was when like we knew like something was up. You know, we were like we must be over the target. You know, we're getting attacked by all these different people, and we knew that eventually this day was going to come. And I mean, it was in the back of all of our heads. And yesterday, unfortunately, you know, we logged on to Facebook, and around 12:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, it was just pure chaos. And everybody was messaging everybody, asking if their pages were down. And then, like, after that dust settled for a couple hours later, Twitter did the exact same thing to all of our profiles on there.
This was a 1-2 punch for you. You didn't expect this from Twitter.
Correct. After Facebook, a couple hours after Facebook banned all of our pages, Twitter did the exact same thing, and Twitter cited no reason. I'm fairly certain that they just worked together with Facebook to purge the same pages that Facebook did. And it was across the board as well. Like our friends in the anti-media, they were banned on Facebook and they also got banned on Twitter. One of our writers, Rachel Blevins, who also works for RT America, she was her page was removed on Facebook and subsequently removed on Twitter. And it just seemed so coordinated that there's no possible way we violated any term or any of their terms of service on Twitter. It's impossible. We just tweeted out links, that's and that's all we did on Facebook too, right? But Facebook has all these crazy different terms.
Yeah, and also Matt, I mean, if the government was shutting down media sites like your site, like Free Thought Press or Police the Police, you'd have an actionable claim because it was a suppression violation of free speech rights. Here we have a private mega monopoly, which has 2.5 billion users around the world, and everybody uses them as the platform. They are working hand in glove with the government. They shut you down. They don't actually have to even explain, at least not clearly, why they've shut you down. It's very convenient, in fact, because that takes away the, in a formal sense, the First Amendment claim. But nonetheless, whether it's takes away that claim or not, it certainly is an act of suppression. It is the negation of democracy. And, I want to ask you about this because we could see this coming. We, of course, here at Sputnik have also had our fair share of this and a lot of attacks. But, when Alex Jones was shut down, and we had this discussion here, even though I'm from the left, John and John Kiriakou and myself, we don't agree with Alex Jones at all, but we felt then that this was just a precursor action, sort of a trial balloon. And after people accepted it because they found, or some people on the left found it acceptable because Alex Jones might be considered so odious, then Facebook would do the same to the left and to progressives and to people who are trying to be authentic, independent media and who may be, a mixture of right and left. Anyway, what's your take on all that?
That's exactly what happened. Alex Jones was just the beginning, and we reported on that extensively when it happened. I even wrote an article called "The First They Came for Alex Jones." We were vehemently opposed to the banning of Alex Jones across the platforms like that, because that just meant that it was coming to everybody else after that, and we predicted that in August, and sure enough, here we are 2 months later, and that's exactly what happened, and it's not over. I think that like there are these sites that disagreed with us a lot, and they're likely celebrating this purge right now. But they're next, there's the establishment narrative. And if you don't toe the line, then you get thumbed out. And that's what's going to come to everybody. If we don't put the word out that this is happening and wake people up to it, to get them to stop supporting such crazy.
Yeah. That's the voice of Matt Savoy. You can still go to your website. I'm there, thefreethoughtproject.com, to see Matt's work and the work of others who have now been part of this big purge by Facebook and by Twitter. Matt Savoy, thank you so much for joining Loud and Clear.
It was my pleasure, man. Thanks for letting us have a voice right now, and everybody else is trying to silence it.
Our pleasure. Thanks so much. Well, that's all the time we have with Matt Savoy. We want to thank you, Matt, for joining us. Now we're going to turn to an interview we recorded earlier in the day with Ford Fisher. Ford talked to us from Washington, D.C. He is the founder of the media startup News to Share.
Welcome, Ford. We're glad to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So we were talking between us, Brian and I, before this segment began, about how so many of these sites that have been dropped, deleted, censored by Facebook are sites that provide legitimate alternative news. You work with alternative news as a way of life, as a vocation. How is this going to hurt you and other independent sources of news?
Yeah, so to be clear, my page, News to Share, was not removed in yesterday's purge. But with that being said, a lot of journalists who I would consider myself an ally with, people who I know in real life, so these are not, people who could even potentially just be, someone, in the Philippines typing fake news at a, at a desk for 5 cents an hour, right? These are real people, not just click farms, working for a variety of different news outlets. So the the problem is that, you know, when one goes down, it kind of hurts everybody, right? When I would share content, some of these pages would share my content. The anti-media, for example, you know, is somebody, is run by people who I'm pretty friendly with. Grenaby and Carrie Wedler are the name of two of the producers that I'm very friendly with there. And the anti-media, which had 2 million likes on Facebook, was taken down. And basically, minutes later, it was actually removed from Twitter. And I knew that it happened simultaneously because they had actually retweeted me talking about their Facebook going down. And then when I tried to find their account again to tag them, it was gone. And so I Googled it, and it still existed on Google. And when I clicked on the Google search result for Antimedia's Twitter, it said, this account is suspended.
Yeah, I did the same thing. And it's on Google, and then you click on it, and it gives you a screen, a Facebook screen, with a note saying that you've made a mistake, that perhaps the page is not does not exist anymore, or you do not have access to the page.
One of the really, really big dangers here is that if the government shut down a media outlet, just shut it down, right? There would be, you would have an actionable case because you would say, look, this is the First Amendment. The government right. can, and the government can't do this. But these are giant private mega monopolies like Facebook or Google. And they can do these kind of things, Ford, without really any serious explanation. And certainly they can say, well, it's our property. We can do whatever we want with it. I mean, there's a huge danger here, given the reliance people have on social media platforms.
Well, especially when we know that these giant corporations like Facebook and Twitter and the others, Instagram, et cetera, work with the government on these issues. Yeah.
But they're shielded from a First Amendment claim, it seems to me anyway. Anyway, go ahead, Ford.
Yeah, well, so like you just said, I mean, what's interesting is that, of course, they're private companies, so they're sort of able to do what they want. I wonder whether governments have kind of nudged them into taking this kind of action. And the reason I say that is that when you kind of look down the broader list, right, so there are, of course, some, you know, primary ones that we were looking at that tend to be kind of anti-establishment. Anti-media is known as an ardently anti-war outlet. It's got some stuff that you'd call left-wing. It's got some stuff that you'd call right-wing. But, like, the uniform message is anti-war. But if you look kind of down the list, it's a lot about cannabis advocacy. It's a lot about top block, police the police, right? So, again, left and right, but broadly sort of police accountability, government accountability, anarchism, libertarianism are all sort of subjects that went down. So I wonder whether Facebook believed that it was giving the government a favor, whether the government asked for this or not. You know, I wonder whether they have some level of kind of hysteria or fear over the fact of this kind of idea of like election meddling and things like that. It seems like Facebook may be trying to sort of appease the state by taking down a number of pages that directly kind of challenge the authority and legitimacy of the state.
Yeah, I think you could easily come to that conclusion. Police the police, almost 2 million likes.
I read Police the Police every single day. And every subgroup of Police the Police, geographic subgroup, Police the Police, Texas, New York, California, also was taken down.
You know, the other thing for it is that Facebook is partnering with the Atlantic Council as if there's some like really independent, neutral, and benign force to decide who's legit and who's not legit. But when you look at the donors for the Atlantic Council, which is a neoliberal think tank here in Washington, D.C., it includes law and it includes government agencies. It includes NATO, for instance. And somehow they become the impartial decider, the filter through which we, the public, get to learn whether these pages are legitimate or not. That in itself is also a nefarious sort of ploy on the part of Facebook. Again, I agree with you. I think they're succumbing to government pressure. I think there's been a lot of government pressure on Facebook, but they're willingly succumbing at this point, and they've set up an apparatus to do just this, which is basically act as a censoring medium so that we don't have the chance to read websites that hold the police accountable or the government accountable. What happened to you, though? I mean, you said your page wasn't taken down, but that doesn't mean you as an alternative media are somehow sort of also protected. Let's just go over what happened to some of your very well-known live streaming events.
Yeah, so oddly yesterday, and this might not have actually alarmed me as much if it didn't happen during the so-called purge of Facebook. Yesterday, I had 7 live streams that Facebook notified me that it accidentally removed and then put back. And it said that, you know, some of your comments and reactions may be missing, but we believe we've restored them. And I looked down the list, and I took a video of this, actually, because I was concerned, oh, this notification's probably going to vanish. It actually wasn't in sort of the list of normal notifications that would be kind of archived. But all of the live streams that it took down were from my presence at the Libertarian National Convention. So in New Orleans in July, there was a Libertarian National Convention where, of course, people are talking about, you know, very different issues of politics where, you know, you have a party that is debating things like, not even debating, that mostly agrees with, let's abolish ICE, you know, let's fundamentally restructure the way that we police, let's legalize recreational cocaine, you know, end of the drug war, right? They're talking about some pretty radical stuff relative to conventional left-right politics. So 6 live streams from that were taken down. And then the other one was sort of weird. I don't think there's anything controversial about it, but I always film the police when there's any kind of a cop interaction. I was in the back of an Uber and it got pulled over for like a lane violation. And I live streamed it just because I always live stream police interactions when I can. I just think it adds safety and accountability to the issue, and it's sort of a form of journalistic activism, if you will. And for some reason, that one was included as well. They claimed that it was a glitch, right? So they said that that happened accidentally. But the facts that that happened during the purge, right, I don't think we'll know exactly what it looks like if you're in the Facebook Silicon Valley office where you decide, you know, who gets the hammer. But I suspect that I was on the cutting floor and that somehow they singled out certain live streams or something that were offensive or problematic to them, and then they changed their mind or something like that. You know, I have a hard time understanding how that happened. The most detrimental thing that occurred to my page actually was August 12th. On August 12th of this year, I live streamed at the Unite the Right rally in Washington, D.C. And to those who don't remember, that was, you know, a couple dozen allies of kind of the original organizer of the White Nationalist Rally in Charlottesville showed up in D.C. Amidst tens of thousands of counter-protesters, right? So by the numbers, you know, it was an overwhelming kind of defeat in terms of presence for them. I live-streamed that event from beginning to end. I kind of had access to the center of it. I had a co-producer who was out there filming the left, and I had access to the right wing. I was going to live-stream from beginning to end, so essentially not a single word that they said would go unaccounted for. And this was used by so-called mainstream outlets. I mean, even the STLC actually had an article quoting my work out before the live stream was even over, and that linked to the live stream. And while I was streaming, right, toward the end of this rally, they remotely shut down the live stream. And so this was what was really interesting about it. I had seen sometimes where people would get content censored after the fact, like after they post something, but Facebook actually took down the live stream in progress. It stopped it while I was streaming.
That's amazing.
Wow.
I have to say, Ford, I was one of the central organizers of the anti-Nazi rally there in Lafayette Park. People really rely on your work. I mean, what you do and what other independent media do is critically important, because guess what? The corporate-owned, capitalist-owned media doesn't actually cover the demos from, you know, beginning to end, and in fact hardly mentions them. And so if people really want to get the truth, they have to rely on Ford Fisher and other, you know, brave independent journalists who are there and who have a lot of integrity and are doing their job. And again, here we have a situation where Facebook can just decide, without explanation, we're going to shut down his live stream. We've entered a dangerous situation.
It's a danger to free speech.
And I think we have to find a way to organize and mobilize people to fight back rather than just accept this as the inevitable. 30 seconds left. You get the last word. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was just going to say that the problem is that so many people are on these platforms. I have a lot of friends who suggest let's have a mass migration over to outlets like DTube, which is like a decentralized YouTube, or Steemit, which is sort of a decentralized kind of blogging platform. I actually started using those platforms. I've taken a little bit of a break from them, but maybe I need to get back on them. I think the problem is that so many people are on these networks, and I don't like the idea of indie media migrating away from it, because it's the people who are kind of asleep and sitting there lazily on those outlets, you know, looking at pictures of their friends' cats.
Right.
We're the ones who should have the opportunity to realize that there's something new, that there are options other than Fox News and CNN and kind of all the rest. So I hope that Facebook takes exception to what they've done. I hope that they reverse at least some of them. I know that there are some efforts to make that happen, but I think the really important thing is that people pay attention to it and not just take Facebook's press release where they claim that they were all spam pages at face value. The reason people are okay with this is that they're just accepting kind of the mainstream media and Facebook narrative that this was justified. And if they actually knew the pages that it happened to, they'd know it's not.
We're going to have to leave it right there. That was the voice of Ford Fisher. He is the founder of the media startup News to Share. Earlier in the segment, we were joined by Matt Savoy of the Free Thought Project, one of the pages that was deleted by Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections. We are joined in the studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Lukman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. And you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook, unless they've been blocked like everybody else. No, I'm kidding. They haven't been blocked.
Not yet.
Anyway, welcome back, guys.
Thanks so much. We're still up so far.
We are 25 days away from the election. 25 days. Less
away
than
from
4 weeks.
Yeah.
So things are starting to gel. And I'd like to start with a new page being run by Politico, which changes more than daily. It changes even every couple of hours as new numbers begin to come in. And both Politico and the New York Times are going to start these live feeds in the coming days, especially the New York Times. They said that they are going to continually, like every minute, update races around the country on this new interactive site that they're launching today.
Okay.
But Politico breaks out the Senate races and the House races, frankly, and the gubernatorial races, which we also want to talk to, race by race by race. So all 435 in the House and then the 34 in the Senate this year, they're all broken out. So I think that now that we're less than 4 weeks out, we can start making some real predictions.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the landscape is becoming very, very clear.
It really is. And I think I'm going to warn our listeners in advance, we're probably going to end up agreeing on all of these.
Yeah, I think so.
But I'd like to zip through the ones that are solidly Democratic and likely Democratic. So the Democrats aren't going to have any problems in places like California. For example, there's not even a Republican on the ballot in California.
Right. And
it's
and
two Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. And there's really not even a reason to bother too much with those.
No.
That's pretty much obvious.
So it's solidly Democrat in California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota. Well, one of the Minnesota races. New Mexico, New York State, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington State. It's likely Democratic, and we won't waste our time talking about these either. In places like Michigan, the second Minnesota race, Montana, John Tester's actually pulling ahead now, New Jersey, Bob Menendez.
Which, that's no surprise.
We talked about his problems, but he's going to pull that out. Where else? Pennsylvania. I mean, Bob Casey, they say Bob Casey every 6 years has a race. It ends up he doesn't have a race.
Right.
People love him. They loved his father before him.
Right.
He's not going anywhere. West Virginia and Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, similarly with the Republicans. There are some seats that are solidly and likely Republican. So those are Minnesota. I'm sorry, forgive me. Both seats in Mississippi.
In Mississippi,
I should say.
It's pretty obvious.
Yep. Nebraska. North Dakota, which we talked about last week, Heidi Heitkamp, I think, is done.
She is absolutely done.
Yeah, I think that Kevin Cramer is going to win that race. Tennessee, we've also talked about at length. Phil Bredesen is fading fast.
Yeah.
And the latest polls have him losing by 8 percentage points against Marsha Blackburn. So Tennessee's likely Republican.
Yeah. Right.
Texas, Utah, and Wyoming.
Yeah,
and surprises.
Yeah, some of those states are pretty obvious. They're solid red. They are Midwest states. sparsely populated anyway, lots of farm country, lots of, you know, deep, deep Trump country.
That's right.
And deep, deep GOP country before they were deep, deep Trump country. So, I mean, Jesus Christ himself had to come in and say, your salvation lies in voting for Democrats,
right,
for any of that to have really changed.
That's right. That's not going to change. The really interesting races are the toss-ups. Now, a lot of them we've talked about on this show. Some of them we actually haven't said much about. I want to start with Arizona. Abdus, we've got this race between two sitting congresswomen. So for the very first time in Arizona's history, it's going to be represented in the U.S. Senate by a woman. We don't know, of course, if it's going to be Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat, or Martha McSally, the Republican. McSally is a Trump supporter. She's made no secret of her support for Donald Trump. Kyrsten Sinema is actually a little farther to the left than previous Democrats have been who have mm-hmm. represented Arizona in the U.S. Senate, the most recent being Dennis DeConcini, who's long gone now.
Right.
But it looks like this could be a serious pickup opportunity for the Democrats. What do you think?
I think that it looks like that it could be a seriously picked up opportunity. But I'm looking at the fact that, again, mentioning that she's far to the left than what people out in that. Now, remember, now we spoke about how the demographics have changed out there.
And that's really the key to this race.
Exactly. So the demographics has changed, but it still didn't change enough in order to bring someone that far left over to win the election. I think what we're going to look at a horse race that's going to be really close, but I think it's going to wind up turning Republican.
Okay, so I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
And I'm so glad that you said that.
Right.
Frankly, the polls have them tied 46-46.
Sure. Right.
So we don't know what's going to happen. I think that it all rests on turnout. And the only reason I say I'm going to disagree is because I never thought that they would throw out Joe Arpaio 2 years ago. And so with Democrats as energized as they are this year and Republicans as despondent in many of these statewide races, I'm going to say that Sinema pulls this thing out. I think it's going to be crazy close.
Well, we'll see.
How about you, Jackie?
Yeah, I actually feel like it's going to lean GOP at like the very last minute. And partially, I really do think, like I've believed we've underestimated, and not just us here, but people in America in politics in general have underestimated this whole Trump wave.
Yeah.
as troubling as it is.
Because people don't want to admit to pollsters that they're racist.
Exactly.
And so they'll say that they're going to vote for the Democrat, and then they go into the voting booth and they pull the lever for the
Precisely.
Republican.
Precisely. And this Kavanaugh confirmation process, these hearings, solidified people's consciousness one way or the other.
Well, that's true. And the New York Times reported this week that for whatever reason, the Kavanaugh hearings helped the Republicans in their Senate races and helped the Democrats in their House races.
Yes, yes. So I think Arizona is one of those states where it's already close, already a horse race. But I think this resentment among conservatives is going to show up at the polls.
And I also think, John, you talked about turnout. But I think what's going to really affect turnout amongst the Democrats is what they just done yesterday, as far as just not even fighting the appointments of these judges. And I think that was a very major mistake on the part of the Democratic leadership, which could cost those close elections could cost the Democrats those wins.
Well, I think this race is going to be decided in the Phoenix exurbs. These are the far out suburbs that are home to enormous retirement communities. So I think really the race, despite the demographic changes, I think it's going to rely or be based on the turnout of old white people.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that's how this race is going to boil down.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Florida. This thing has gone back and forth and back and forth. And now Senator Nelson, Bill Nelson, is back up again in the polls. And for whatever reason, Rick Scott has dropped down. Now, we don't know what Rick Scott's response to Hurricane Michael is going to do to his standings in the polls. This thing is shaping up to be the most expensive Senate race in the history of the Republic.
Yes.
They're going to spend $500 million for a job, to run for a job that pays $200,000 a year.
And I got to tell you, that's just obscene. Every time I hear the amount of money these people are willing to spend of their, I don't care if it's their own money. If you personally have $500 million to spend to run for this job that only pays $200,000 a year. You couldn't find anything better to do with any of that money before now?
Right. Imagine the good works you could do with $500 million.
Like
the
prepare.
People you can train
right.
or feed.
Like
right.
prepare
or
your state to combat climate change,
right.
which is, I think, why Rick Scott is plummeting in the polls.
Well, that could be it. There was a piece in the Miami Herald this week saying that even without the hurricanes, climate change is having an effect on Miami that no one had anticipated. And that is that the rising sea level is causing salt water to leak into the aquifer. And so Miami's drinking water is turning salty. Well, Rick Scott has prohibited the State Environmental Protection Agency from using the term climate change. They're not even allowed to speak the words climate change. They're not allowed to write those words in any state-generated report. Well, you can't just deny that it's happening and then expect it to not happen.
Right. Right,
exactly. And then when the manifestation of the thing you've just legislated doesn't exist yet, so you can't talk about it, actually shows up on the coast of your state.
That's right.
And destroys entire communities, then your former voters or your potential voters are sitting there going, well, something caused the strongest hurricane to destroy our community that has ever hit the shores of the United States. I mean, this was caused by something.
I mean, but this was definitely a gift for Bill Nelson, though.
It really was.
Yeah, in a weird, just kind of obscene kind of way.
Well, you know, the funny thing about representatives and senators who are serving in Washington compared to governors is the governor has to actually respond to a natural disaster, right? And he's judged on his response. All a senator or a congressman has to do is go to the floor of the Senate and the House and say, I call on the president to send emergency funds. And that's all he has to do.
That's it.
So you're right. I mean, this was a gift for Bill Nelson four weeks before the election.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Nelson's going to pull this out.
I think he will too.
Yeah, I agree.
How about in Indiana? We've got Joe Donnelly against Mike Braun. Mike Braun's a tough candidate. Donnelly had a weak opponent last time. He had a Republican, a Tea Party Republican, who made some asinine comment about good rape versus bad rape.
Right. Oh, right.
And then threw
that.
The election away. Mike Braun's not that stupid. He's a good campaigner. He's effective. He's young. He's good looking. He's well financed. This is another one that's a toss-up, and in fact, Politico isn't even able to take a position on it.
Right.
What do you think, Abdus?
Well, I have to go with Politico. I mean, that's just how close that it is. I mean, maybe Mike Braun might pull it out just based on his good looks and all, but really, it's really hard to call.
That's one of those that I'm not even going to try to guess what's going to happen. I can't tell whether wind is going to blow there. Nobody can. And that's one of the ones that we're going to be watching until the very, I think we might be watching that one for a recount even after the election.
That's what I'm thinking too.
This could be one of those races that we don't know for days or weeks who actually wins. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think Donnelly's going to win because his name recognition is better. He has a little bit more money. It's an anti-Republican year. And I think that might be enough to give him an edge. But with that said, any other year he loses this race.
That might be true. That might be true.
It's a total guess. I pulled that out of the air, but that's what I'm thinking. Okay, maybe the toughest race in the country, Missouri. This is Claire McCaskill, who probably should never have won a Senate race from the state of Missouri, versus Josh Hawley, who's like young enough to be my child. It's insane to think of.
Right.
But talk about good looking. Mm-hmm. Retired special forces,
right,
war
right.
hero,
oh, the whole resume.
State attorney general.
Yeah.
The guy's the perfect candidate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's the single perfect candidate. And again, in any other year, we wouldn't even talk about this race because she wouldn't have a prayer.
Yep.
But she has this odd way of pulling out, of eking out these victories by like, you know, four votes.
Yeah.
However, it's because her previous two opponents have self-destructed.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see this. I don't see this guy self-destructing though.
No. He's been doing everything right. I think
right.
she loses this one.
I think she loses it too.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I agree. I hate to say that, but another thing about her, about Claire McCaskill, is that she's never pulled a Joe Manchin. in which she says, well, you know, I should probably vote with the Republicans because I'm a moderate. No, none of that. She was Barack Obama's biggest supporter in the Senate. She was the first senator to endorse Barack Obama for president. And she makes no apologies about her progressive voting record in a state that really does not like progressives.
No. And they dislike Obama even more.
They do.
Yeah.
They dislike Obama even more.
Yep.
I think she loses this race.
Yes. Yep.
Another tough one. And frankly, I'm not sure why this is so tough for the Democrats, is Nevada. You've got Dean Heller, who's the incumbent Republican senator. Dean Heller, from the very beginning of this election cycle, has been described as the single most vulnerable Republican.
Yeah.
Well, he's up against Jackie Rosen. Jackie Rosen is a terrific campaigner. But for whatever reason, Heller has not self-destructed. The unions have not come out as strongly for Rosen as everybody assumed they would.
Right.
And Heller's really in this race. Both CNN and Politico call this a toss-up, with no guarantee at all that Heller's going to lose like everybody had predicted.
Nevada is one of those states where I can't pin down what the politics really are, because it's such a disparate population. You've got Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's Las Vegas. And then you've got the suburbs of Las Vegas, which is a mismatch of different issues. You know, you've got what's the guy, the Bunny Ranch guy, who actually ran a credible looking campaign.
Yeah.
I mean,
he has. It's crazy. The guy is the owner of the largest brothel in America.
Right.
And he's a serious candidate.
Right. But I also think that this goes back to what we spoke about earlier, about this being left up to old white people.
True.
And I think that, you know, I know it's close, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're going to be the ones to save Heller.
You might be right, but I'm not going to touch this one either, because I really don't know.
I really do. I think that they're going to be the ones, and in the end, it's going to be one of these real close ones. But I think that old white people are going to. And then, you know, John, you said something about it being an anti-Republican year. I think that we have seen an increase in the Democratic base's interest and that activity in the midterms, especially I believe it's Maryland, where the absentee ballots have went through the roof, you know, people,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
But at the same time, I don't really feel personally that I'm willing to put too much faith in this anti-Republican rhetoric, because we've been there before.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
You know, only to see.
That the status quo remains in these states with incumbent Republicans.
Right.
But I'm still not touching Nevada. I'm still not going to get that one.
I hate leaving races on the table like that, but I can't call this one either. Well, you know what? Maybe I will. I'm going to say that if we are this close to the election and Heller has not blown it, because everybody said he would.
Right.
I think he's going to survive this.
I do, too. I mean, I really do.
And you know what? That, unfortunately, that's the key in so many of these very, very close races. Whether the challenger or whether candidates screw up really badly.
Yeah.
It's not who has better policies that appeal to people.
No, because nobody's talking about the policies.
No, it's whether someone says something that trips them up and tanks their campaign.
Now, it's not that. The same's not true on the House side. On the House side,
right.
The polls are saying that it's all about health care.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Not the tax cuts. Nobody's even talking about the tax cuts. It's all about health care, and especially it's all about pre-existing conditions.
Right.
So in these House races, we have real issues being debated. In the Senate, nobody cares about these issues.
No. And I think that's the reason why we've said before, and I'm still under I'm still in agreement that's where the blue wave is going to be. The blue wave is going to be the House, you know, Senate. No.
I agree 100% with that.
Yeah.
I think there really will be a blue wave in the House. There are two polls, one from Quinnipiac, which is one of the best polling companies in the world.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other from CNN. Both saying that the Democrats in the generic Democrat versus Republican race on the House side, Democrats have a 13-point advantage, which is tsunami territory.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, just this morning, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, the RCCC, announced that it would stop funding the campaigns of Republicans in toss-up races.
Wow.
In order to try to save what incumbents they can that are in leaning Republican races.
Right, right, right.
So I think the Republicans are conceding the House of Representatives.
Now, counter that with what you brought up, Abdus, what the Democrats just did in order to get a recess, in order to go to the recess to campaign for these toss-up Democratic toss-up Senate races. The Republicans, the RCCC, not funding toss-up House races, that doesn't cost them anything.
No.
It doesn't cost them anything. It doesn't cost the voters anything. It doesn't cost them anything. What the Democrats just did with appointing those judges, those appointments of those judges to Trump so they could get this recess.
That lasts a generation.
That costs us everything.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I'm if the Democrats weren't going to pick up the Senate anyway, so for them to have conceded that to fight a losing battle, they should pay for it. They should pay for it.
As we wrap up the Senate, I think we're mostly in agreement that the Republicans and Democrats will either break even or the Republicans will pick up one seat.
Right, right.
I don't see any big change in the Senate.
No.
I mean, maybe for a minute, a month ago, there was a chance that the Democrats could recapture the Senate. It's not going to happen. And Jackie, the most important issue, as you say, is these new judges being appointed.
And, and if I may add to that, John, what you just said, this is bad news for all of us, because even if what comes true, that the Democrats have the blue wave in the House and the Senate remains, you know, practically the same, what does that mean for policy and legislation going forward? What does that mean for unclogging the wheels of government to get some things done? I'm looking at more gridlock, partisan politics,
doubt.
You know. So do we really win in all of that?
And Politico said this morning there will be no changes in the Democratic leadership. Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker of the House. She's 78 years old.
Right.
Steny Hoyer will be the majority leader. He's 79 years old. And Clyburn of South Carolina will be the Democratic whip. He's 78 years old.
Right.
So this talk about a new generation of Democrats,
No.
Mm-mm. It's not going to happen.
No.
We're running out of time, so I want to skip real quickly around some of these gubernatorial races. The Republicans could pick up Alaska, which is currently led by an independent by the name of Bill Walker. He's the incumbent governor. Alaska's a weird state. They elect libertarians and independents all the time. You never knew who's going to win those races.
Yeah, real frontier. I mean, that's a real frontier kind of mentality.
The Democrats are going to pick up Colorado in Jared Polis, the former congressman. But Florida's a tough race to call. You've got Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor of Tallahassee, and won his primary in a great upset versus Ron DeSantis. Mm-hmm. You know, Ron DeSantis is kind of newly legendary for his extreme right-wing views.
Yeah. Right.
He surrounds himself with white nationalists, Klansmen, etc.
Yeah. I think Gillum is up in the polls, and I think he will actually win.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think Florida's ready for a change, which also makes me think that Nelson is okay. Nelson's in good shape.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Georgia.
Oh.
Wow. What a race. So we've got Brian Kemp, the Republican, who's the state secretary of state, versus Stacey Abrams, who would be, which first of all, she's the first black woman ever to be nominated for governor in any state in America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And she would be the first black woman governor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this race is tied.
Yeah.
With that said, let's go back, Abdus, to demographics.
Right, right.
Georgia's changing more than any other state in the South.
Yes, yes it is. Yes,
and
it
so
is.
The Democrats are seeing blue. Do you think that's going to happen?
Oh, I definitely believe it's happening. I mean, we're looking at Atlanta, even Atlanta suburbs have had major demographic changes.
Which used to be Republican strongholds that threw every state race to the Republicans.
That's right. And and it's no longer the case. And I think that we're going to witness history here.
Yeah. And it doesn't even matter what Brian Kemp, I'm not saying it's not important, but this new thing, well, it's not new because he's been doing it since he's been Secretary of State, this new effort at voter suppression of of majority African-American voter registration.
Desperation. That's the desperation right
it's
there.
It's a desperate hand. Yep. He knows that he is in trouble. The ground game of Stacey Abrams of grassroots volunteers, just like in Gillum's race in Florida, is amazing.
It is absolutely
amazing. And all of those things, I think, are going to coalesce to a win for Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Real quickly, Iowa. We've never discussed Iowa.
Yeah,
To tell you the truth, I don't know a lot about this race. I can tell you that Terry Branstad was governor for like 150 years until he was nominated to be ambassador to China. So he's off to Beijing.
How do you get to be ambassador to China after you're the governor of Iowa?
It's wheat sales.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Yep. Okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
Because everybody
likes
wheat.
It's all about wheat sales. Yes. So Branstad went off to Beijing, and Kim Reynolds, who was the lieutenant governor, became governor. She's running against Fred Hubbell, who's a Democratic businessman. Mm. He's well known across the state. He's a big businessman, but he's got zero political experience.
Right.
Still, they're calling this race a toss-up. It's a tie in the polls, and we really don't know what's going to happen. I can't take a position because I really don't know either of these two people.
Neither can I.
Just kind of interesting to me.
Right.
More interesting to me is the Nevada governor's race. The reason it's interesting is because you've got the state attorney general, Adam Laxalt, who is the son of Paul Laxalt.
Right.
Remember Paul Laxalt from the 80s?
Yep.
Paul Laxalt was Ronald Reagan's best friend in the world.
Right.
And he was the head of what was then called the kitchen cabinet. Mm. So this was an informal group of poker buddies that used to quietly advise Reagan to do things that his own cabinet would tell him not to do.
Okay.
Okay. So I remember reading even once that Laxalt had this special code. So if he needed to write a letter to Reagan and get directly to Reagan, he would write the code on the envelope, put that in another envelope, send it to a secret address. Well, it would go to this one White House person who would open it, see the code, and then carry it directly to the president.
Wow.
So that's who Paul Laxalt was. Paul Laxalt died earlier this year. He was in his 90s. And now his son is trying to establish himself as the successor to his father's Republican legacy in Nevada. This is a tough race. He's running against a Democrat named Steve Sisolak. Nobody's ever heard of Steve Sisolak outside of Nevada, right? But Steve Sisolak is the chairman of the Clark County Commission, and Clark County is Las Vegas.
Yep.
So that's where everybody in the state lives, in Clark County. And so if you're going to nominate a Democrat, Steve Sisolak is probably the guy you want to nominate. I think that's why this race is undecided. Now, as we said with the Heller race, which is too close to call, this one is also too close to call. I think it all depends on turnout.
Yes.
It's easy to say that Laxalt has the name recognition. The truth of the matter is most Nevadans are relatively new to the state and don't remember his father.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
But
exactly.
Steve Sisolak is in the newspaper every single day.
Wow.
As the head of the commission.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, sometimes these are the races that show that sometimes name recognition, good campaigning, does lead to voter turnout and can make a difference. I mean, we hate to look to say that it's not policy. Sometimes it really does come down to that for
sometimes
voters.
Sometimes it does. We've got less than 3 minutes left. I want to blow through two more gubernatorial races that are important. Ohio, Richard Cordray, the former head of the Consumer Finance Protection Board, versus Mike DeWine. Mike DeWine's been in Ohio politics forever. Mike DeWine beat Cordray several years ago to be a state attorney general. Now they're both running for governor. Too close to call. They both have great name recognition. Mm-hmm. Even though Ohio's a purple state, it tends to go Republican in Republican years. It tends to go Democratic in Democratic years.
Right.
I'm going to call it for Cordray.
I think I might call it for Cordray too, only because of his association with the very popular CPFB. Other than that, I think it would have gone Republican.
Yeah, I have to agree with you guys.
I think so. Wisconsin. Scott Walker, arguably the most unpopular governor in America,
yes,
at least for Democrats, is running against a guy named Tony Evers. Evers is the state superintendent of public instruction, essentially the superintendent of all of the state's public schools.
Oh.
This race is all about education.
Yes.
You remember it was Scott Walker who broke the teachers' union.
That's right.
So it looked twice previously like Scott Walker was going to lose, and he pulled these races out. This one's too close to call. I think Walker's going to win it. I hate to say that, but the guy's a survivor.
I am hoping in the power of teachers again, but I really don't know. I really don't. Scott Walker's got more money than teachers and the unions.
Yeah.
Well, not only that is the fact that even what we witness, this momentum of teacher activism, I don't think that it's strong enough to reach.
I think that's right.
I think that's a great point.
Okay, very quickly. Mike Bloomberg this week very quietly registered as a Democrat.
What a traitor.
Yeah.
what a traitor.
It was largely ignored, but he registered as a Democrat. I think he's running for president. Yeah. John Kerry, in an interview with Politico magazine for their blog, said that he's interested in running for president again. Just a shameless self-promoting plug.
Don't do it.
I wrote about this yesterday in Reader Supported News.
We read that.
People are pretty angry.
Yeah,
not with me.
That.
They like me, but they're angry with John Kerry. The last thing in the last 30 seconds, fascinating governor's race in Rhode Island. The Republican nominee just admitted that he killed a guy in a traffic accident back in the 80s. He apparently fell asleep at the wheel. He didn't want anybody to know. And then the Republican turned independent nominee for governor admitted that several years ago he got in a fist fight and beat up the Speaker of the House of Rhode Island. And the Democrat is licking his chops. I think that's an easy win for the Democrats.
Are you sure this is a gubernatorial race and not like an episode of The Sopranos or his boss?
As we were talking about earlier off the air, the Democrat has apparently organized crime ties to the New England Mafia family. So anyway, that's the best governor's race in America. We are completely out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Luqman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Luqman Nation. And you can check out their political live stream, which is very interesting, every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.